Hello everyone, Adam Allington here. Earlier this year, we brought you a series of stories looking at the experiences of African-American lawyers and judges as they shared their perspectives on why the legal industry remains one of the least diverse professions in America. It's now been over a year since George Floyd's murder and the wave of soul-searching that followed. And still, 16 of the nation's largest law firms, 9 of which are on the AmLaw 200, according to a report from the American Lawyer. With that in mind, we decided to put together an extended cut of my January interview with former Attorney General Eric Holder, now a partner with the Washington, D.C.-based firm Covington & Burling. The interview was part of our Black Lawyer Speak series, which is still available. Just search for Uncommon Law wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And now my interview with Eric Holder. As I said before, the majority of this podcast series has been focused on issues of diversity and inclusion as they relate to big law firms or the recruitment pipeline. But is diversity also a topic for the judiciary? And how would you say it's similar or different to what's going on at firms?
Well, I think diversity is always a good thing. I think that's one of the strengths of our nation. We are truly a nation of immigrants. I think we have tended to forget that. So our immigrant past, I think, is a strength, and it is the foundation for the diverse present and the diverse future that I think we should have. If you take America and all of its constituent parts and involve people from different backgrounds, from diverse backgrounds, whether it's racial, gender, geographic, you end up with the best efforts. You end up with the best of who we are as a nation. And so it matters not only for what you see in corporations, what you see in the military. It also matters in all facets of our life. And I think that is true of the judicial branch as well.
At the firm level, I think this issue often gets folded into a business case model. You know, we can provide a better service for our clients if we assemble diverse teams. Is that the right way to frame the issue for the judiciary as well, that diverse benches can produce better legal opinions or results, or are there other reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think people, you know, judges are supposed to decide things only on the basis of the facts and the law, but we'd be naive to believe that people don't bring their life experiences to the job. I mean, I was a judge for 5 years, and I dare say that my experiences as an African-American man gave me slightly different perspectives than some of my my white colleagues. And I think that, you know, that's a good thing to have a variety of people from different backgrounds, different life experiences. You know, you lead a pretty solitary life as a judge. And people tend to think, well, a judge is only deciding cases on the basis of the facts and the evidence in front of him or her. But the reality is that judges interact with one another. And we used to, at the D.C. Superior Court, where I was a judge, we had a lunchroom. And that was a great meeting place for judges. And judges could only sit with judges at a designated table. And we would frequently talk about cases that we were considering. And it was really interesting to hear the different perspectives that different judges had presented with the same facts, understanding what the law actually was and the different ways in which they would view a case. And so, and I think in those interactions, people were sensitized to different views, sensitized to different life experiences. And I think it made us better, made us better judges than if we were all, you know, from a very homogenous background. And so I think there is always value to be found in diversity. And I don't think that's a political statement, you know. I think we've tended to politicize something that I think we can scientifically prove. It certainly helps in business. And I have to think that when it comes to decision-making on the bench, just as I found with regard to decision-making in the executive branch, having a diverse set of people around me to share their views, to share their recommendations, made me a better decision-maker, both as Attorney General and I think as a judge.
Over the last 4 years, the Trump administration has moved with remarkable speed to appoint judges. The last count I saw was 174 district court confirmations, 54 appeals court judges, and of course, 3 Supreme Court justices. Many progressive groups have also noted that the judges also stand out for their overall lack of diversity. At the district court level, only 17% were non-white, which compares to 37% under your old boss, President Obama. And at the appeals court level, Trump made 54 appointments without a single black judge, the first president since Nixon to do that. So I just wonder, how would you rate the track record of the Trump administration here?
Well, you know, we were on an arc starting at the end of the Reagan administration until the beginning of the Trump administration, where the federal bench was becoming more diverse. If you look at the appointments that Trump made, they are 85% white, 76% men. It's, you know, the least diverse group of federal judges, appointments to federal judgeships since Ronald Reagan. You know, Trump's appointments have made the federal judiciary less diverse at a time when the nation is becoming, you know, more diverse. We're on track now. Well, we say, you know, America's going to be, will not have a white majority by 2050. That now has been moved, I think, to 2043. Increased numbers of people of color. The courts don't have their chief weapon. The thing that makes courts effective is their perception of them being legitimate by the population that the courts serve. And studies have shown that people tend to believe in institutions, in companies that reflect their world. And again, this is a nation that is increasingly becoming more diverse, that's becoming more brown. And to have an administration kind of almost run counter to these demographic changes, these demographic trends, which are inevitable, kind of almost like, you know, these are going to happen, to kind of try to turn the clock back, potentially robs courts of that legitimacy. The courts now are, aside from the military, among the most trusted institutions in our society. And you put at risk, you put at risk that sense of legitimacy if people look at the courts and see judges that don't reflect, you know, what the nation looks like. And it doesn't mean that you have to have precise numbers, you know, that actually totally reflect that which the way in which the nation is constructed. But some sense that they are, you know, roughly in tune will be something that will, as I said, keep the courts viewed as being legitimate.
You mentioned President Reagan, who appointed you to the D.C. Superior Court. Of course, everyone remembers Ronald Reagan for his Supreme Court appointments, the first female justice, the first Italian-American justice, which was actually a big deal at the time. But when you look at his two terms in total, that also wasn't a very diverse group of judges. So I wonder, were you at all surprised when your name was put forth?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's the process by which judges are selected in Washington, D.C. for the Superior Court is kind of a unique one. You apply to a judicial nominations commission, and then three names are sent to the White House, and then the president makes a selection. And it's interesting because of the function of that commission has led to the creation of a bench in Washington, D.C. that is extremely diverse. You have judges who were formerly public interest lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, people from big law firms like I was a former prosecutor. And it's also racially diverse and gender diverse. And so the names that went up to the White House when I was being selected were three African-American men. And so, you know, the Reagan White House had to pick between one of the three of us. And I think that, you know, that's in some ways an example of a process that I think probably ought to be replicated, you know, putting before the decision maker diverse slates in the same way that, you know, we have at Covington and Burlington working with the NFL come up with the Rooney Rule, you know, that you if you're going to pick a new head coach, you have to at least interview people of color. Doesn't mean you have to select anybody, but you have to interview people of color. And it's interesting that when you make that a requirement, that you interview people of color, you interview diverse candidates, you then end up selecting people who are diverse because it pushes people out of their comfort zones where they only look for people who look like them, went to the schools that they went to. People need to understand that there's not a tension between diversity and excellence. You know, you can have a diverse bench and have nothing but excellent judges. They might not all go to, you know, have come from Harvard, Yale, and Columbia. They might not have only come from the northeastern part of the United States, but they're really great lawyers who can be great judges all around the country.
I wonder what appealed to you about the job of being a judge. Was this something that you'd always aspired to?
Yes, interesting question. I became a judge at the age of 37, which I think is a little young. And my intention was, having been a litigator in the Justice Department for about 12 years or so, you know, when I was selected as a judge, I thought this was it. You know, I've reached kind of the pinnacle of my career. And I thought I would just, you know, be a judge for the rest of my career. It turned out that I became a judge at a time when the crack wars were really infesting Washington, D.C. And I had coming before me as a judge in the D.C. Superior Court this ocean of young, this wave of young black men who I had to send to jail and had to impose these mandatory minimum sentences that I didn't think were necessarily consistent with their conduct. And I burned out after 5 years and made a decision to leave the bench, and I became then, you know, the U.S. attorney in Washington. So I think that had I been a judge later in my life, had I become a judge at a different time in our nation's history, it might have been something that that I stuck with. But I felt at age 37, I guess to 42 when I was a judge, that I was a referee in the middle of a game where I still wanted to be a player. And so when the opportunity arose to become the U.S. attorney, I decided to apply for that.
Bloomberg Law covered a story recently about the promotion of the first female African-American attorney to chair an Am Law 100 firm. As someone who is a pathbreaker yourself, you know, obviously the first African-American attorney general, I wonder if you feel that there are more opportunities for African-American attorneys today than there were, you know, 10, 20 years ago. Do you feel confident that things are moving in the right direction?
Yeah, there's no question that progress has been made, and it's easier for the generation now than it was for my generation. You know, they stand on my generation's shoulders in the same way that I stood on the shoulders of the generation before me. Things are better. They're not yet at the place where they need to be. And we still have firsts. You know, we still have firsts. In the 21st century in the United States of America, we still have firsts when it comes to, oh, me, you know, first attorney general, as you were saying, first head of an Am Law by an African-American woman, head of a firm. So, you know, progress has been made, but our journey continues. And there are still difficulties. There are still perceptions. There are still stereotypes that have to be overcome. You know, the notion that African-Americans, people of color, are going to be good advocates as opposed to, you know, corporate lawyers. They're going to be good in court in front of a jury as opposed to not being so great and maybe in an appellate setting. You know, these are things, stereotypes, things that are unconscious biases that are, you know, unfortunately ingrained in, you know, throughout our society. And we have to be aware of those biases and counter them to make sure that people are given the opportunities that they are entitled to. Because the reality is companies, benches, you know, law firms that are aware of these biases and calibrate for them, and they become better, they become stronger, they become more competitive. And that's just as true. That is just as true of benches. You know, we don't think of that, I think, often enough. What's the strength of this particular bench? You know, we're talking about the D.C. Superior Court. What does the D.C. Superior Court bench look like? How strong is that bench? As opposed to, say, maybe, I don't know, you know, the Supreme Court in New York State. I mean, how strong is that bench? How diverse is it? Could it be made better? These are all the kinds of questions that we certainly apply to companies, to corporations, to law firms. And we ought to ask those same questions about, you know, about judicial entities as well.
The Biden administration is already committed to nominating an African-American woman to the Supreme Court if they have the opportunity. In terms of priorities, where do you think rebalancing the federal bench will fall? Do you see this as being high on the list for the next president?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that, you know, the president-elect campaigned on. I think he's a man of his word. He's also a person who's had a great deal of experience having chaired the Judiciary Committee. So he's seen what the process looks like. And his commitment to put on the bench a diverse set of people, not just prosecutors and people from big law firms, but public defenders, public interest lawyers. I think that is certainly something that we can expect to see from the Biden administration. And I think that's going to be good for America. But I also think it just puts us back on that arc that I talked about earlier, that arc that was started actually with George H.W. Bush and continued, you know, through Republican as well as Democratic presidents, you know, to greater degrees, lesser degrees, but on that general arc that was really stopped by and reversed by these last 4 years of the Trump administration.
You'd mentioned that, by and large, the judiciary was still one of the few branches of government that the public has trust in. Given the level of political polarization that we're seeing these days, I wonder if you see the judiciary playing an even bigger role going forward, keeping the guardrails of democracy in place.
Yeah, I really do. I'm very concerned that in these hyper-partisan times, people will look to government writ large, I mean, executive branch, judicial branch, legislative branch, looking for, some part of government to be neutral and to apply, you know, neutral principles in deciding things and doing things that is in the best interest of the people. And it is why it worries me about what happened again over these last 4 years. But that's in some ways unfair. What has been a trend in the United States where we have politicized the selection of judges. And if the judicial branch is simply seen as an extension of the more political branches, that will ultimately and negatively impact the way in which they are viewed by the American people. And so we need to have a strong, diverse, neutral bench at the state level, at the federal level, to maintain that confidence that the American people have in the judiciary. And then beyond that, I mean, that is substantively something that we need to have so that we're having judges make decisions not on the basis of ideology or partisan views, but on the basis of what the facts are, what the law is. And so that when a decision is reported in the federal, from the federal courts, it's not said that, well, they were two Trump judges and one Obama judge. You know, we got to hopefully get away from that so that people simply say, you know, two judges voted this way, one judge voted that way, without any kind of demarcation of who the president was, who appointed the judge. Those are subtle things. Those are little things about what kind, you know, who appointed the president, what's the nature of the decision. And it's legitimate. You know, it's legitimate now. But I would hope we'd get to a point over time where that will not be something that gets reported and people will not perceive decisions as coming from, you know, Obama judges, Reagan judges, Trump judges, but simply from federal judges. And that's what we need to get back to. It's important for our society.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add or maybe a question that I haven't asked?
No, I mean, I guess, you know, what I'd say, you know, if the composition of our courts gets too far out of step with the composition of the nation. And that is a danger that I think we must avoid, but it's also a danger that we can avoid. You know, if we are careful in how we go about the selection process, if we cast a wide net to consider, good candidates, irrespective, you know, of their party considerations and people of a particular race, you can end up with a bench that is as strong as it needs to be, that will have the trust of the American people. You know, the opposite is a problem, but it's a man-made problem, and it's susceptible, you know, to man-made and woman-made solutions. We need not find ourselves in a place where our courts lose their legitimacy, but it will require some effort, because this stuff doesn't happen to us as Americans, and we never want to concede this, I think, or too often we're reluctant to concede. It doesn't happen to us kind of naturally. We all carry with us these biases. And this is black folks as well as white folks, Hispanic folks, you know, Asian folks. We all carry these biases about people and other groups, and we need to recognize that we have these biases and then, correct for them.
The That was former Attorney General Eric Holder speaking with me last January. Holder's interview was part of episode 5 of our Black Lawyers Speak series, which focused specifically on issues of diversity in the judiciary. And if you have any feedback on this or any other episode of Uncommon Law, tweet at us at BLAW, B-L-A-W, or email us at podcast@bloombergindustry.com, or leave us a voicemail at 703-341-3690. Again, thank you for subscribing to Uncommon Law, and we'll have a whole new series coming up in a matter of weeks, which I think many of you will find timely. I guess that's the word, timely. I don't want to give the topic away just yet, but stay tuned to this feed for an announcement soon. Thank you.
My name is David Schultz, and I'm here to announce On the Merits, a new podcast from Bloomberg Law that brings you everything you need to know about the biggest legal stories of the week, coupled with smart interviews and analysis on a variety of topics, such as the incoming Biden administration's judicial priorities.
So I think diversity is kind of the watchword here.
We'll also keep our eyes on the Supreme Court.
Now everyone is on Breyer watch. We're all watching to see when or if Justice Breyer is going to step down.
You'll hear voices and perspectives from across the legal industry, including reporters and editors, attorneys, legal scholars, general counsel. But lest you think this podcast is all just news you can use, from time to time, we stumble on a court docket or legal opinion that, for whatever reason, just piques our interest.
And he started this opinion, 224th of it, citing the Passchendaele battle. It's one of the largest battles of World War I.
That seems like a strange way to start off an opinion on corporate law.
You can download On the Merits wherever you get your podcasts.